Hale, thank you for attending session 221. This is titled Why Ritual Makes Sense. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters, or presenter in this case. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave if they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping the symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstores in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and their scholars. This session is 60 minutes long. We ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. Religious ritual is strange, but there is a method to its madness. The many forms that it takes, from meditation to ecstatic dances, from solemnity of the LDS endowment to ceremonies involving psychotropic drugs, all point towards a coherent vision of who we are and how this secret is so easily obscured by our day-to-day experiences. This session explores why ritual can lead participants to feel empowered with a greater sense of orientation and peace. Dan Witherspoon, who most of you are well aware of already, holds a PhD in religion from Claremont, correct? And is the host of the Mormon Matters podcast. He's also the former editor of Sunstone Magazine from 2001 through 2008. Many of you might not be aware, but he plays a mean tenor sax as well. Dan?
Sexy sax. I myself am not aware of that particular fact. Actually, I did play alto sax like 6th or 7th grade and didn't end up going that route. But I think most of you who know me know that I'm pro-religion. I tend to defend it. I consider it an overall good in the world. I know it's been a good in my life. I recognize, of course, that it has lots of dangers. Potential for manipulation or abuse, control, for enthroning and keeping enthroned things in the status quo that really should be moving on. So it's not certainly an unadulterated good. But when I do defend it, it's usually pretty early on in whatever the context is that I will speak how of its defenses because it very explicitly says there's something more to us than what our brains can think, what our words can say, what our five senses tell us. That there's sort of a depth and a richness that whatever we are, this consciousness and this, you know, awareness that we have on ours is sort of sitting on top of much deeper connections. And so in waking life and in waking times and things like that, we're constantly, well, we're much of the time on autopilot, right? We're just going through and we're not recognizing that this isn't a solid, in its fundamental nature, that this isn't a solid thing. We don't recognize that we're only getting a certain part of the spectrum of light when we're through our eyes. There's waves and energies and all sorts of things that we're not doing. We don't reflect on those things just in the waking consciousness. And I think sometimes because of the day-to-day troubles and the day-to-day struggles and things that come to us, we don't reflect always and remember because it just doesn't come up in day-to-day life that you always need to, you know, go to that deeper part of yourself and feel connected. But I like religion because it simply puts us in an awareness again that that's a part of our life that should be attended to from time to time. So I like, if nothing else, that once a week we have a religious day that is, or we have a day that, at least in the Western stuff, is not like the other days. And ritual is basically the part that I'm going to talk about, why it makes sense and stuff like that, is always going to, I'm not going to give you a ton of ritual theory. I'm really going to mostly just do the structures and things of ritual. And once you kind of get the basics of how it works, you can sort of predict the rest. And then I definitely want 20, 30 minutes of Q&A. But, and you to share your questions and things about ritual. But ritual basically is intentionally trying to say, let's separate this moment or this from regular types of experience. And so this first slide that I have up here, for a couple of Greek terms, you'll probably recognize the term chronos as the origins and the roots of what? Chronology, sequential time, sort of a sequence, and those different things. Chronos is day-to-day living. It's quotidian life. It's just the normal march of time, and us, generally, like I said before, we're in reaction mode to it. We're on autopilot. We're not really thinking deep and thoughtfully all the time during a kind of chronos time. But the Greeks recognize there's a qualitative difference in some types of moments, right? That there are moments of expectation, of uncertainty, of possibility. They just feel different. Aristotle goes along and says somewhere along the lines that it's that, you know, when you've been working on a problem really hard with your head, it's in kairos time that the proof or the answer will come. It's that time when you you're just in sort of a different mode, and there's recognition. So what I wanted to mostly emphasize as the key to this is that ritual is deliberate in its attempt to say or to bring us to modes of consciousness and to get into that energy that, again, I was sort of like, not energy, I don't know if that's the best term, but to get us into those deeper questions and things like this. It's trying to drive us there periodically. And so it works structurally, and then it works with a lot of symbolic stuff. So let me quickly, as I've been talking here, I want to make sure I haven't missed something key here. So what is ritual, basically? Ritual involves actions. So can you guys all recognize that? There's different gestures. There's postures that we would take with our body. There's certain sequences of actions that we might take. They're often highly symbolic storytelling and lots of interplay of things that you go, okay, they're obviously, they're making something shimmer here to know that I'm supposed to be pointing beyond that particular thing. Various disciplines, sometimes it involves relocating ourselves or our bodies. It has many forms. We mentioned in the abstract, things like prayer, meditation, breath awareness and control, dancing. You've seen the ecstatic dancing. We've seen the dervishes whirl and things like this. We've seen shamanic drumming. We've seen dancing, the kachina, all sorts of things like that. All are basically ritual actions, all fit within them, but how is it that they connect? How is it that they take us to this new place is what we're gonna talk about here. A couple things. So those were kind of forms and things that are pretty much always involved, but sometimes the rituals will also include new clothing, new names, given a new identity, the sense of being birthed into a new person or a new things, along with special foods, drinks, and objects. And so my basic plan today is to teach you a little bit about just very basic ritual structure, throw on the symbolic layer, and then just we'll kind of end with just kind of seeing how the temple sort of fits into this and stuff like this. I did want to say at the beginning, my interest in this, it came during my master's thesis in religious studies at Arizona State, and I had, returned from a mission, and I was having pretty active and wonderful spiritual experiences in the temple. And yet, I'm studying, with my brain. I'm in mode of academic stuff, and I would ponder about why is it that going to this temple, doing these ritual actions, all this repetitive stuff, all this, you know, frankly pretty boring, stylized, strange things, why is it that I would come away somehow feeling better? You know, what was it that was working on me? And so I studied ritual, and I got a lot of things. Now, I guess the point I wanted to make, though, is that coming out of that, I didn't thereafter enjoy ritual more. In some ways, it actually cost me some of the naive, because I can see what's happening here, you know, and it takes you a while, you know, to kind of get back into your mode. But ultimately, and I think this is why I'm giving this presentation today, as a smart person and as a person who's big on my mind and I want to figure it out, and that's why I titled this Why Ritual Makes Sense and all this kind of stuff, is I wasn't anymore, after learning this stuff, able to enjoy it because I knew more, but because it made sense to me, I was able to sort of give into it. So can you sort of get what I'm saying there? In other words, I just sort of yielded up to it and said, okay, I'm willing to go with this strange stuff. I'm willing to do these things. And that fear that you might have, like, oh, if I give into something that's non-rational, you know, or if I give into something that's going to take me out of my brain, we have that kind of fear that we're betraying, you know, this apparatus and these things that make us so great. I found that I could think better about it afterwards. So in other words, go ahead and feel free to yield, and don't worry, that you can still think afterwards. And so I've got a slide towards the end that I will try to make that point bigger. So here we go. Let's learn just a little bit, and most of this, for any of you that have studied this at all, you will recognize what's going on here. I'm going to use basically, why is it, there it is, okay. Ritual structure. This comes from Victor Turner, is a famous anthropologist, and he basically borrowed and used Arnold van Gennep's thing. And Arnold van Gennep was the first one to sort of start to name three phases of ritual, and his were specifically in rites of passage. So there's lots of classifications of ritual, but rites of passage are the ones where, for instance, puberty rituals or something like that, when you maybe go from the right, from in a primitive or in a tribal society or something, you go from being in the world of children, and then you are inducted into adulthood and things like that. So he studied this, but it turns out that these three phases are quite prominent in almost every ritual. First of all, you're just going along in chronos time, and you begin a ritual through some sort of act of separation. So let's think about some of the ways that we designate the beginning of a ritual, and we'll see that it's deliberately to do what? To take us out of that normal space and time. So what might you do like to begin a prayer? What?
Kneel.
Yeah, kneel. So change your posture. You know, if at one, you know, that's certainly a good one. Many of us kneel. Some of us probably have a prayer chair or something like that, if we're not as able to kneel or something like that. You might do certain, gestures or things like that. So, yes, so that's one of the things. Relocate, to say I'm going to a special place or a special sanctuary or whatever for these things. We just, again, we'll talk about the temple later, but what else might you do? Change your clothes. Please. Yeah. Good. As a way to start moving into.
Right.
Yeah. Nice. You know, I'm probably for the recording, I probably shouldn't do. Like, this is a classroom. I would rather just be teaching in the classroom. I don't even like making slides, and you can obviously tell I'm not very good at it. So rites of separation. So in other words, we deliberately say, I am about to do something that I don't want the normal modes, just my day-to-day, my unthinking life and stuff like that, to be dominant. And so the liminal phase is clearly the action phase. And okay, so day-to-day experience. One of the terms we'll bring up here is structure. That's a Victor Turner term. It says you're in structured time and then chronos time. But then when the liminal phase, we move into anti-structure, again, a Turner phrase. The word liminal comes from the term limen, which means the threshold. So like a doorway or something like that. And so there's this sense that there's in this, you're now in a threshold time space mode or something like that in the liminal phase of ritual. Turner will talk about you're between and betwixt, meaning, you know, certain, structure and anti-structure for him. Normal rules don't apply. What's one of the things, for instance, that happens when you change your clothes and you enter into a ritual and you're all dressed alike? You now no longer have social cues and things as readily as play. So there's sort of a leveling that can happen. You might take on a new identity. You might get a new name. You will learn that you are going to move into, instead of 21st century things, you're not going to move into sort of more of archetypal energies. You're going to sort of talk about fundamental basic questions. You're going to be wrestling with things that are at that deeper sort of core area. If it's a rite of passage, for instance, there's explicitly talking about you being in the womb, that you are in the process of being reshaped and reformed and being born into a new person and things like this. Part of that leveling, part of the no longer social status applies, is that, and often because, especially in, you know, puberty rituals and things like this, sometimes a lot of physical ordeal. There's a, sometimes he talks about a sense of community. Communitas is the word he uses. Sort of among the participants, we've gone through an ordeal together. We're truly bonded to each other from this ordeal. So ritual can kind of work on you to where people from complete different walks of life, let's say in the army, you know, and there's lots of things that go on here when you go into the army. You're going to cut your hair and you're going to get a uniform that's together, things like this, and you're going to go through lots of things, and yet you're bonded for life because of the stuff that you can do during rituals and things like this. And again, you're more explicitly, and I forgot the quotation mark, in Kairos time. So in the liminal phase of ritual is, again, the action phase and things like that, and we're going to talk about it a little bit more later. But the next one is when you do your acts of reintegration. This is where you are going to work back into normal space and time at the close of the ritual. And what I tried to show there, and it was, I just drew the stupid thing, and I should have redrawn it before I started putting things on it. But I tried to show there that as you complete the ritual, the idea is, as you reintegrate into life, I had a more of a gradual slope there. Can you kind of see this before you get back to normal time and that level? The idea is that in the ritual itself, you feel empowered. You feel different and things like this. And there seems to be a period of time at the end of a ritual where you do feel like you're operating at a higher level. You sort of see things at a higher plane, more clarity or something like that, because you've done this immersion into something different. So, please, Kim.
A tiny thing. I'm not a huge fan of the temple experience, but whenever in the pre-iPhone days, I used to always wear a watch. And when I changed clothes, I would always take off my watch. Just instinctively, I knew I was moving to a different kind of time.
Nice. Nice. For those who didn't hear, maybe picking up on the tape, taking your watch off in time, you sort of just sense that. It wasn't like a deliberate, yeah. So as you reintegrate, you again change back to your clothes, you maybe go back to your normal things and stuff like that. But the goal or the idea is that you now have been, you know, illuminated. I'm going to use an example, this is a great quotation from Alfred North Whitehead. Now, he's actually talking about scientific discovery. He's talking about empiricism. He's talking about, he's not talking about ritual. Let's put it this way. But he has this great line. He says, the true method of discovery is like the flight of an airplane. And he's, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century British. So that spelling. It starts from the ground of an observation. So it starts in chronos time we're going to talk about here. It talks in empiricism. Here's something we're observing here on the ground. This is something I want to study. Then it makes a flight into the thin air of imaginative generalization. So this is more like it's into the liminal phase where lots of possibilities come. It's you can speculate, you can do all sorts of things there. But then when you land again, and it again lands for renewed observation, which is now rendered acute by rational interpretation. So in other words, now you go back to the rules of logic, you go back to the rules of rationality, you go back to the other rules, and somehow you see the ground more clearly. So can you see sort of that ritual? Because you've been now in touch with something deeper within you, because you've now let your cognitive filters down and things like that, you now can see life and feel that orientation and stuff a little bit better. So it just dawns on me that we ought to do a few more things that can happen in ritual to create liminality and things like that. Often, and this will be a part of the temple stuff too, we know that we study, or rituals have mythic overlays. So there's certainly ones that don't. I mean, there's complete ones that try to, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go to a different slide. Let's go to Plato's Cave for a minute. Do you guys know this allegory very well? Is there anyone that would like a quick explanation of it? Okay. From his Republic, he talks about the human condition is basically, it's kind of stuff I talked about earlier. We're not living in a full awareness of the true reality. Our minds and our structures and everything we see around us is not reflective of true reality. So he has us like we're prisoners in a cave. Can you see the prisoners' parts there? And they're staring at the wall. They're staring at the wall ahead of them. And then there's people that are, you know, holding little puppets and things like that, and they're walking along the roadway. And the fire that's behind them is casting shadows on the wall. So basically, he's basically saying human condition is that we're walking in a shadow reality. You know, our main thing is we're mistaking reality for shadow. I mean, shadows we're mistaking for reality, right? And yet the human who's there is not really chained there, but they've just assumed that that's the deepest reality. But they could get up theoretically and begin a journey to where they could get to true reality. So with Plato, we have these prisoners. They could climb up that little area there. They'd begin to see the diffuse sunlight from the mouth of the cave, and then they would get out, and they can walk out the cave, and then they can go out into the real world. And there, through the light of the sun and stuff, they would see a tree. And so where they might have been able to see an image of a tree before, they now can grasp, you know, the forms and the ideal, all that, you know. I don't want to teach too much Plato. But the idea is that they can retreat. So one way to the enlightenment, one way to the real, is through these quiet, contemplative, I'm trying to get rid of all thought. I'm trying to get rid of symbols. So those of you who studied some meditation and things like that, right? You know that there's the quiet your mind. Get out of this. I don't want a story. If a thought arises, I want to get rid of it. And there's those kinds of things. That's a little bit that way. Now, but let's think of something else here. This is a move that not a lot of people do. What's another way out of this cave, theoretically? If let's say this cave was in the side of a mountain, besides turning around and going away from symbols, what could you do? You can go right into them. Theoretically, you could drive through that wall of that cave. And now, of course, I don't think that Plato and I, my personal thing is you can never get to pure unmediated experience. But some things in ritual seem to work because you unite more fully with things that you recognize as simply symbolic. So a symbol is kind of the thing that's pointing at something else, and you recognize that it's pointing to something else. And instead of getting away from it, what could you do? You could go right into it and escape that way, or at least come to do it. So there's some things you'll read in the literature that says, like, I discover the God by dancing the God. You know, or in other words, I really get to know things better through doing it. And so again, some of you may have been in Mark Kriego's thing just recently here. A lot of his stuff was, I don't even know if I'm going to make the point. But anyway, you've heard the term the finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. You know, this thing is pointing towards an experience. It's pointing towards realities and things like this, not it. We're mostly walking around in our lives confusing that for the thing itself, and we want to make to do it. So ritual kind of gets us there. So with the symbolic overlay, I've got a really long quote here, really the actions towards the bottom here. But one of the main things that will happen in a lot of rituals is you will have a reenactment of the beginning times. And so here with the temple, we have that certainly in ours. And so he talks about the reason that the beginning is so important is because this is where all the possibilities are laid out. This talks about the biggest changes, you know, the change from nothing to something and things like this. So I'm not sure how much I want to read. Let's just read the second paragraph. I'll just go. By depicting the greatest contrast in the modes of being, creation and creation stories, etc., reveal what change means. Creation accounts provide the basis for imagination, thought, and reflection. That is, for the ordering processes that make the cosmos a home to humankind. So by studying the fundamental changes that went from nothing to something, or things like this, we can reflect on them better and kind of feel at home. So let's just quickly look at the temple as this structure. So we've already talked a little bit about one of the things you do. You physically go change. You know, you drive to a new place that's designated. You what? Take off your day-to-day clothes. You enter into some sort of ritual clothing. You know that this is not normal clothing. You know that it has specific purposes that have different rich meanings. You take what? You take on the role of some archetypal people in your foundational myths, right? So in our case, it's Adam and Eve and things like this, and we are symbolically Adam and Eve, and we get an account of the creation. We get some of the basic ideas that our tradition teaches, that God was behind creation, that it evolved over different times, that it was called into being, that wasn't from nothing. We get all those kinds of things. And we just orient ourselves to say this. And along the ways, we get the idea that this was good, that God approved of each way. And so we're sort of in this story that kind of tells us that that we are in a home that had some purpose. What do Adam and Eve do? They make choices. And these are archetypal choices, aren't they? They're very basic ones. They're things that, you know, we can apply into our current lives now, but it's only because they're the more basic level and different things like this. And so we symbolically follow along and do the same choices that they do. How are we dressed? We're dressed like everybody else. We change things during it. We're like a rite of passage. It's an ascension. In other words, we go from telestial to terrestrial to celestial beings and things like this. We're trying to come out of the temple having a higher understanding that we've ascended to something higher and things like this. And then as we, you know, go back into our daily lives and things like that, we feel more oriented. We feel there. I think there's a tendency among us to, because when we're in faith crisis and things like this, we are belief oriented, you know, because that's the easiest way to contrast things. Here's what I used to believe. Here's what I believe now. One of the things that I think that ritual has taught me and do things is it's not so much what I believe, but how I feel in the universe. So it's like a movement from believing to centering to being centered and things like that. And that's what I think ritual can provide for us. By taking us out of our heads, by taking us out of our normalcy, by putting us back in touch with possibles and confusion and fullness instead of separateness, instead of all those different things, we can really, be reminded of bigger things. And so at the end, we do come out more. I'm not positive. I quit looking at my notes, so I'm sure I forgot some things. But does it make, so I guess my go back to my abstract here. What is it that we know about, what does ritual teach us about ourselves? To me, again, that it's important to know our full selves. It's important to explore all the depths, all the different aspects, to stay out of our heads and let the other stuff kind of come in there. And so in that way, so the title of this, does ritual make sense to you? Can you see how, even though it looks weird and it is weird and it's strange and it's repetitive and all those different things, that kind of drives it out? Can you kind of see where it's uniting you? So that's really what I wanted to say. There's certain things like stylized activity and actions that also, there are studies that show how that, you know, make sure cognitive filters do all the sorts of things like that. But I'm just going to ask for anybody who wants to talk about ritual just to come up to the mic and let's have a good conversation. And I would love anybody here who is, you know, grounded in this to answer questions too. So Tom, please.
Yeah, we had a little talk about this over dinner last night, and Dan asked me to bring up a certain aspect of this, but when you have a liturgical service, you begin with an introit, and therefore that's the calling of the saints as they come in, you know, like they're coming to the New Jerusalem, or they're coming out of, as you so beautifully said, as we would say, they're coming into ordinary time. They're coming into a liturgical experience out of the world. And so they're being called. A kaleo takes place. Okay, then as we move from ordinary time into the kairos time, or the expected event, like the New Testament says, in the fullness of time, the Messiah entered into the world. You know, Christmas is not ordinary time. Easter, with the resurrection of our Lord, is not ordinary time. The liturgy takes us from outside the sanctuary into a new reality. Now, as a priest, colors are very important. They were in the ancient temple. The white means the purity of speech. That's why we give a homily. Black is the color of overcoming the world and overcoming yourself. So there is the church's theology embroidered in the activity as we move from ordinary time into liturgical time. The emphasis here is during Pentecost, it's also red, okay, or blue for the end of Daniel's kingdoms and so forth. So it's teaching us the reality that we're in transition to the new world.
Yeah. Now, what I'd love you to talk about that you talked about with me last night is the repetitive nature. A lot of this thing that bugs you about knit rituals, it's so repetitive, right? It's just so boring, it's so mind-numbing. Well, you've kind of forgotten the joy. It's supposed to be mind-numbing, right? It is. It's supposed to, at a certain point, it's supposed to become so familiar to you that you're now free to do the dives, you know what I mean? Rather than be on constantly doing it. But Tom had an interesting point last night about the repetitiveness.
Yes, we're on a triennial cycle in the liturgical world. And the reason is you'll go through 1 year of the reading of Scripture. And they used to do this in the ancient temples too. They'd have a lectern priest who would read and recite with the congregation, you know, because that's preparing your hearing for for what you're about to see. And with the changing of the robe or the clothing or the undergarment that symbolizes the new birth that you're about to take on. Now, the reason it's repetitive in a yearly cycle is because at the end of the cycle is the new birth. Now the beginning of your birth, which takes place every year, it's like a rebirth of the spirit or the soul in a person. So each year it takes on a new meaning. It's adding something to your growth towards the celestial kingdom, as it were. And so that's the beauty of it, and that's why you have the scriptures read. That's why you have homilies. That's why you have instruction, because you yourself are learning to become the very thing that you're imaging.
Yeah, right. That was the line there at the end that I was going at. The idea was that you are engraving, you know, in your personality.
Yes, you will become.
Yeah, you'll become what you repeat.
In the temple endowment or in the liturgical ritual.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Russ?
As you know, I was one of the first. Is that better? As you know, Dan, I was one of the first LDS chaplains after the Second World War. And is that up? As you know, I was one of the first LDS chaplains after the Second World War. And I'll never forget Elder Packer telling us, there were six of us sitting there in the First Presidency's conference room, and he said, your job, complaining about the cross on our shirts, and he said, your job is to out-Protestant the Protestants, so get busy. That was a little bit of a cognitive dissonance thing, so I got busy. My first boss was a Missouri Synod Lutheran who hated Mormons, and he was assigned by his boss, a Catholic, to teach me how to lead worship. And he would attempt. One day he used the word liturgy, I'd never heard it. We happened to be sitting in the office of a Baptist religious educator who looked like Santa Claus and acted like Santa Claus. And the Missouri Synod Lutheran, with smoke coming out of his ears, turned to the Baptist and said, would you explain to Chaplain Osmond what liturgy is? Santa Claus turned around, complete with belly jiggling, Southern Baptist. And he said, oh, liturgy, that's the stuff you put between the songs. Now, I give you that introduction to make a point about worship in Mormonism. The chaplaincy was an incredible experience for me. It taught me that the cyclical repetition outlined by the person standing here before me is what the Jews do. They start at the Torah at the beginning of the year, and they unroll it each week. And they have a ritual at the end of the year to roll it back up and start over again. It's exactly what happens in Islam every day in the five prayers. Islam reduces itself to the hand, five fingers. And all they're doing is what that gentleman said. Our temple ceremony is an invitation to do that, highly inconvenient, terribly dated, and for many years of my life, boring as however you want to describe that. Saltaire is gone, but the temple is not. And you've got to slow down. It is a liturgy. And oh, by the way, it has huge elements of the Catholic Mass in it. Forget the Freemasonry stuff. So thank you for this phase diagram of liturgy. Without it, you really can't have a testimony, using Mormon parlance, that will sustain you. So in your experience, thank you for letting me expostulate for a moment.
Thank you.
This is important stuff.
It is important.
And in your experience, what is worship in Mormonism? It's important, I think, to your topic.
Nice.
Thank you.
And again, I was trying to it's how powerful this stuff is, but it's precisely because it's not head. It's not stuff we can think. It's the deeper stuff, and it's that dialogue between them. And the point I was going to make about Mark Kriego and his thing came back to me again during Russ's thing, that it's not like it's in the middle. It's the tension is a oneness towards it. As I'm saying, so when you're out of the ritual and your head is, you know, doing its thing, and you're in the ritual, and hopefully you've kind of gotten below that there. It's not like you're ever going to be able to reconcile the two, and yet life and happiness and joy and balance. And he did a whole bunch of Eastern Taoist, you know, stuff for us. It's a oneness that you do it. And so I shortchanged the section on symbolic action and why you often will do rituals, but they have to do with like reaffirming meaning in a time when meaning is you know, hard to do. And so when Russ said something about Saltair is gone, but the temple isn't, it's like, but I guess I don't even know what my point was there. But our ritual does change, though, right? We've all seen it. How many of us did pre-1990? Yeah, it's really changed, and it's changing again and again and things like this. And so we are in dialogue with it. And so as the world changes and as different things happen, our rituals do change. But yet they've got that solid structure like the temple versus Saltair. A little bit there, but please. I didn't hear that. But oh, Saltair was gone because it's not in dialogue with community. Thanks, Russ. I want your comments more than mine.
Okay.
So, please.
Well, I mentioned the phenomenon of childbirth, and I would say to you, Father, that the liturgy is but a type and shadow of the first birth, this great mystery of childbirth. And it occurs to me, along with that, for me at least, I have twins. That act was so commonplace, happening hundreds of thousands of times every single day on this planet. And yet, for me, the most transcendent and freakish experience in my life to date. And along with that, which brought me into this new realm of godhood for that moment, mm-hmm. But also the secondary experience along with having brought forth new life, and that was take and eat of my body, the breastfeeding of twins, which a mother can't do this on the run. Our brain secretes hormones intentionally to slow us down and create this liminal kairos experience. And it's so interesting. In German, stillen is the word for nursing, and it's the same word for silence. Mm. And being brought into that space where I could not do anything but be still as these two beings partook of my body. And again, there's nothing else in my life that has even approached that.
Thank you for sharing. Wonderful. Sure. Gorgeous. Yeah, and liminal phase is, you know, often talked about, you know, it's right at that the heavens and the earth are coming together, you know, in that threshold too. And, you know, life and death, and it's all in the balance and everything in that. It's really wonderful. Please, Jeff.
Two questions. One is, do you find that there's less respect for the Mormon temple ceremonies compared to other religious or tribal traditions? Sometimes I feel like when I'm reading that we'll take a look at a culture that has ritual and it's very respectful, and but the
Mormon, we're still fair game, you know. So for
yeah, it's not okay. Yeah, yeah. I didn't know if anybody else. I'm not feeling defensive. I was just noticing that it's there's like a holiness to other rituals, but not necessarily even our own inside of myself. Right? Having to feel special. And the second question I had was: there's a lot of concern about the costs for building temples, and is there anybody reimagining how we could have these sacred rituals, which I do think are important for touching that deeper level you're talking about, without the cost. We go back to maybe some tents in the desert or something.
Yeah. Has anyone else heard that they're doing a floating temple that would be able to go up rivers and various waterways as a way to do it? So I've heard that that's coming. You know, certainly we got the smaller models and things like that. But yeah, that's certainly a big thing. Now, you know, I honestly, I'm probably a minority among, it just seems like the internet chatter for the boards and stuff we listen to is, I doubt we'd use that $8 million to really feed the poor. You know what I mean? And with this, there's symbolic value for being beautiful and all those sorts of things like that. And of course, we can get lost, and you know, there's a shadow to everything like that. But I haven't been a big critic of that. But I do like the idea of making it available to more without this whole, you know, we might lose a whole general conference beam or whatever of the journey of the lifetime where the family saves for 20 years to go to the temple. And all of us, if we remember our first temple experience, we probably weren't as joyful. And, you know, I mean, we were joyful that we now received the endowment, but I don't know like that. But I would love to see it more available. But I heard somewhere that they're working about barges or whatever for some of the things like that, which would make good. Does anyone know anything? That they're going to do mobile temples. Okay, somehow. Great. Well, thanks. Good stuff, Jeff. And on the other question, I don't know. I think at some point, I think we're moving closer to where, like, hey, quit making fun of the Mormons, you know, because they would never make fun of a Jewish ritual, right, because of the Anti-Defamation Leagues and stuff like that. And we're just not quite that to that point where you know, our sensitivities are honored, you know. And, you know, when your garments and all, I mean, the church put the garments, of course, online and stuff now and are trying to do it. So I think we're moving in a good direction with that. But I think right now you're right.
My name is Marianne Pond. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, and I wanted to see if anyone else had experience with gaining more understanding, love, and deepening feelings about the temple by participating in rituals and traditions of other traditions. Nice. And I loved the previous class. I'm a yogi. I don't know if there's any other yogis in here that love Buddhism and Hinduism, but I definitely have felt that you know, participating in yoga and meditation and understanding ritual in general has given me more of a deep understanding of my own tradition. Exactly. And years ago, I was able to watch, and probably a lot of you are familiar with this, the YouTube that shows jihad, or the returning to Mecca, when you see thousands of Muslims, you know, when they
the
all...
Hajj.
Yeah,
you know,
Hajj. What's it called? Hajj. The Hajj.
Yeah, the Hajj.
When they all, you know, bow.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
Bow together at once. Yeah. It's like the most moving, and you can see that. So I think that's the difference between the respect for ours is people, because it's like secret or behind closed doors, they don't understand it. But so many of, you know, other religions, their rituals are out in public. So I wanted to see if anyone had thoughts on that. But I also just wanted to share, because I... you know, I've embraced breathing and yoga and have done yoga for years, but recently, a few months ago, I was able to go to a yoga retreat where literally the sequence and the breathing and the chanting was the same every time. So three times a day, the exact same sequence, chanting and breathing. And it was so meaningful and beautiful. And when one time we did it in the morning on the beach, and literally right after we finished the chanting, the sun rose. And I was like, I think we just rose the sun. And you just realize, you know, you're just doing this ritual in relation to your, you know, yourself, to God, to the world and nature, and it's just beautiful. So I didn't know if anyone had any thoughts on how that goes together and deepens your experience.
It certainly has mine. And that's really why I started with the defense of religion in general, because what's happening in Mormonism is, it's the same process as everywhere. Now, Patrick, you're actually fourth. So, get on that front row. So, I think you're next if you wanted to chat. But thank you, Marianne, and definitely the more religions you do, the more Mormonism, we're right there with them. You know, we've got all the goods. You know, we just get lost sometimes with the the weeds.
My question is whether you feel like rituals wear out or wear well. Hmm. Meaning, when we start a ritual, we sort of explain, like, here's the symbolism of this. Here's why we're doing this. As he just explained, the liturgy is like, it means this and it means that. And it's like, if we were to go practice that, then we would immediately start thinking about what those things are. On the other hand, there are rituals we're involved with. I think of Christmas. We put lights on the tree, and I have no idea what that even means anymore. Yeah. But we go through all these things, and it's lost. We've lost the connection to what the metaphor or the symbolism of that thing is. So my question to you is, do you think that rituals are only useful kind of initially when you kind of are aware of what all those symbols are, or do you think that they're actually benefit to doing them in the absence of even knowing what those metaphors are and just doing them over and over and over again, and there's something that takes place? You know, that there's some value to putting lights on the Christmas tree, even though we have no idea what it's all about anymore.
Let's leave your Christmas stuff out of there, because we all know that the candy cane is the shepherd's crow crying. I wanted two things. I think we'll get to questions, but stay there in case we don't. So, okay. Two things. I don't think most rituals go out of their way to explain themselves to you. You know, that's all the post-reflection kind of stuff. And that's where I was kind of trying to say that no matter what, you have your experience of the ritual, and then you've got your cognitive explanations and things like that. And this will never explain that. And so it's important to have both things going, you know, at a time, and to be in tension with those things. I really think that that's important. But the thing about the ritual is for it to disappear. So when you say doing it over and over and over again, what the ritual should become for you is more like the koan or the something like that, which is the trigger that simply says, I am going into this space, you know, to be, have it become so familiar to you that, you know, maybe one thing will step out for you that time. But for the most of the time, you've been free, you know, to be in that, like the airplane, the flight of the airplane. You're in that imaginative generalization mode that then you bring back to the you know, on the ground problems and things of your life and stuff like that. So I don't know that ritual wears out. I know that ritual has to respond to the change of society and things like that. And so I think most of us are happy when we see the Mormon temple change, right? Right, it's all been changes that were needed as society says, okay, that was an artifact that we didn't need, and this was that, and stuff like that. And so I'm glad that it's in a dance with things like that. And so, in some ways, that keeps ritual fresh. But the bigger question for me is, no, the more that you do a ritual, I think the less you're supposed to be thinking.
And your thesis is that the less less that there even is a metaphor that you're trying to capture, the more value there is to it. Meaning, like, in some sense, the less...
Right, okay,
the
I guess I'm thinking a little bit more of the repetitive actions, the gestures and things like that.
The more value you get out of it.
Yeah. When you're talking the real symbolic stuff, where you know this is a symbol, the more... you're right, symbols will... Symbols can show their limits. Yeah. But again, that's a little bit more like I'm talking about with the uniting with the symbol as much as you can. Then you kind of break free from it and you get into the, you know, what it's pointing to. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'm doing any kind of good job. But I appreciate that because, again, I know that that's some of you came here, why is the ritual so boring? You know, and in some ways, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, have anybody heard Adam Miller? He's got a piece called... what was it? The mundane as a, or something, boredom as a, you know, a mystery, you know, an invitation to mystery, you know, or something like that. It's along those lines is how I look at it. Same thing. You know, I read scripture and it's familiar and stuff like that. It's almost like scripture is now just my invitation to go into symbolic space and time and you know, ponder life's things. And, you know, my eyes wander and maybe I think my subconscious mind at some point will find an actual text that most of the time it's just, I just scripture is that invitation into space.
Okay, something. Thank you.
Do you want to respond to him really fast? Yeah. Exactly. That's you're successful when it's less. Yeah. Oh, she just says it's a vehicle just to send you into that thing. So if, I don't know if we have time for everybody. We have 5 minutes, so probably not.
I'll try and keep it quick then. So. Ritual to me, I kind of think of it in lots of different kind of, it's a large umbrella. We're kind of focusing on spiritual rituals here and kind of getting to a higher enlightenment as a goal. But how do you feel about it as just the experience in general, not necessarily a goal-centric experience? Because not if you put it out as an if you do this, then you get that,
yeah, no.
Then sometimes you get left disappointed. So Do you think that there has to be a goal in mind when you go, for example, the temple? When you go to the temple, if this, then this. Or do you think it can be more of a journey versus a destination kind of an experience?
Yeah, the latter, don't you? I think if you have a goal of like, I'm going to the temple in order to get a blessing, or I'm going to the temple to get an answer to the prayer and stuff like that. I think those things can happen. But I don't think that, you know, when, if it's your goal, yeah. It's like you're, you know, this is a, I'm putting in my quarter, I want my gumball.
Exactly, because yeah. A lot of people will find themselves in different areas of that spectrum.
Yeah.
But these rituals came from somewhere. They started mm-hmm. somewhere where somebody said, you know, this ritual gives me this result.
Exactly.
And so they kind of spread it out amongst other people, hopefully they can get the same result.
But exactly.
If it doesn't happen, then do you think that goal is necessary?
So. Yeah, yeah. There's actually a theoretical thing I like a lot. It's a pretty minority position, but the idea that ritual comes before theology or becomes before story and things like that, that somebody, you know, on the top of a mountain was pondering in a certain way and maybe in a certain posture or something like that, and they had an enlightenment experience, and then they wanted to repeat it, so they went through, did their different things, and then they wanted to share it with their friends and says, here's how I did it, and things like this. And then after... It's after the experience they start to theorize what might you know be involved there. So it's a guy named Fritz Stahl, it's called Rules Without Meaning, that actually talks about all religion being based on these powerful experiences that then you have to explain. But anyway, it was a great question, so I'm glad. I think you've made your own points really well. But
and I just have a last one here. And this is short. It's not even a question. I just what you said, and it kind of ties in, I think, to what we attended last session with Mark. It triggered, and I hesitate to say the source because it may be met disparagingly, but Laura Schlesinger, who I used to listen to. Who I used to listen to on the radio. Right. But something she said that stuck with me, you know, the 10 years since she said it, was she said, don't wait to participate in rituals or spiritual, I don't know, reading scriptures or whatever, until you see the meaning in it or it's meaningful to you. But by participating, yeah. It will acquire meaning
yeah.
for you.
Yeah, I think that's what happens. And that relates to your thing, too. Your motives change through the time. Hey, you guys, again, you can tell here, I didn't have a big thesis. You know, other than, I think, pardon me? Yeah, okay. Other than I love my mind, but the more that I've lived, you know, the more that I've studied and things like that, and where I find peace and where I find centering is when I play not only with my mind, but in these more archetypal, uncertain, full realms, that each time I dive, a piece of that energy comes back with me, or an insight or something there that makes my life clearer. And again, I know that when we're struggling with faith and when we're wrestling and everything's topsy-turvy, we want it to make sense. And so I was just trying to get you to say that this weird religion stuff actually can make some sense, even though, again, it's not going to be the kind of sense where you can explain it with your words and things like that. So that feeling that I had going to the temple and then learning this ritual material and, you know, overlaying it on there, and, you know, and maybe now next time as you guys go, oh, I'm seeing, you know, this or that, hopefully that'll fade away too. But the fundamental thing of, like, I feel better. I feel more centered. I feel more oriented. I have something that I came out with that I didn't go into. That's just what, again, I wanted to raise up, and I'm glad we had an hour together to talk about that. So thank you.